is in Denver, where the local government manages a herd.
Snow was falling fast and hard at a mountain park west of the city earlier this month when 34 bison were gifted to four tribes or nonprofits. Denver has managed two small herds since the early 1900s and started giving some animals to tribes 6 years ago. Lewis Talbull is with the Talbull Memorial Council, which has members from various tribes. This year, the organization is taking one bison back to a property it manages near Denver.
The bison represent so much. They represent the water and the fire and the thunder and the clouds and the snow. At the same time, they represent us as indigenous people.
Tribal leaders said the animals would add genetic diversity to their growing herds and help feed tribal members with a historic food source. The Navajo Nation got 11 bison in the transfer, and Northern Cheyenne in Montana received 10. I'm Rachel Cohen.
Thanks so much for tuning in with us here on the KBOO Evening News for this Thursday, March 19th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes producer Annette Newell, our engineer Otto, and our director of evening news, Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, text KBOO to 44321. And stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to the KBOO News In Depth. I'm Artie Wall. For years now, election deniers have questioned the validity of our elections, especially when Republicans don't win. Justin Glaw is an independent journalist and the founder of American Doom. They were the first media outlet to file the motion to unseal the Justice Department's affidavit that led to the FBI raid at a Fulton County, Georgia elections warehouse on January 28th. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Glaw about how election deniers might affect the midterm elections in November.
The nationalization of elections, is that even possible? I mean, states run elections, counties run elections, and the president has indicated he might want to change that system. Would he be able to do that? Or he's mentioned 15 states or 15 places, 15 states. How would he go about doing that if that's even possible to do? It seems like a complicated election system.
It is a complicated election system, and that's a really good question. And I think it's one that we're going to be, that courts are going to have to weigh in on, unfortunately, because really what I've been reporting on over the last 4 or 5 years is the ongoing phenomenon of interference in elections by acolytes of Donald Trump and election denier forces within the Republican Party and on the American right. So, you know, in a way, the nationalization has been already happening in the form of what I've taken to calling sort of like a decentralized coordination of these election denial movement type folks in advocating for a lot of policies that are, you know, various levels of voter suppression and things like that.
So they probably wouldn't need to nationalize elections if what you're saying is true, that they are making these efforts to suppress the vote and to challenge elections and to challenge voter credentials. Is that right? That they could tilt elections their way state by state, right? Which is kind of what they've tried to do anyway.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, when Donald Trump says, let's nationalize elections, the reason that I think that that my focus on local election officials and state election officials and the movement of election denialism over the past several years is important and is related to what he said is because when he says nationalize elections, what he means is what they mean also, which is effectively that no one who is not a supporter of Donald Trump and who believes fervently in the lie of widespread election fraud should be in a position of power over election administration. So he doesn't really know what he's talking about when he says nationalize elections. It's not actually possible, as you point out. The Constitution is pretty clear on that. However, it's in spirit the same thing as what a lot of the folks I've reported on, it's the same spirit that they have, which is they want a kangaroo court for elections. They want to run up and down the chain of command, every facet of American elections, to ensure that only their side wins.
I remember in the Bush-Gore race and in the John Kerry race, there were questions about the voting machines and flipping votes towards the Republican candidate. And now it's the opposite, right? That the Trump people are suggesting that the voting machines are rigged in favor of Democrats. Do you get that sense?
Oh, yes. Rigged in favor of them, rife with fraud, part of ongoing and past campaigns by foreign governments, all manner of conspiracy theories that you can imagine, which is why I wrote a piece in my newsletter, I don't know, last year, I guess it's already 2026, but that said that, you know, this one of these executive orders that Trump issued pretty early on in his second term was everything that the election deniers wanted, because it effectively called for a prohibition on voting machines. Because the election denial movement has, you know, been saying for years now that voting machines shouldn't even exist. They want all hand count elections. They want hand marked paper ballots to be counted by hand in every single election. And that to them is this North Star of the only way out of having elections that are rife with widespread fraud.
I have heard progressive activists say that as well.
Sure. Yeah. No. And look, I mean, there are people who, especially since 2020, who on the left have also been saying, you know, we should do away with these voting machines entirely. And you know, part of their argument is we're never going to get anybody to trust any election that has voting machines involved in it, whether or not there's actual fraud or hacking or anything, which in my opinion, based on the facts of my reporting and a lot of other sources like the 60 lawsuits that Donald Trump lost in the wake of the 2020 election, there is no such thing as widespread election fraud. The voting machines are not being hacked. But yes, to your point, even some on the left have said, we need to do away with them. We need to go to all hand-marked paper ballots. It's just not really feasible, from my understanding and everything that I've read and reported on, for a country with a population as big as ours, that is not really feasible. And in fact, what we're seeing in Georgia right now is a push towards that legislatively, that there's a very important deadline coming up in July. And I won't bore you with the details of that, but essentially, you know, what will happen is if there are moves toward hand marked paper ballots and hand counts, there are going to be significant errors in counting. There's going to be all sorts of recounts. And this is all just going to feed this monster of distrust that the election denial movement sows in election results. Only of those that Republicans don't win, by the way. Let's be clear about that.
If voting machines are used by states across the country, is there a way to verify those votes? I mean, there are vote recounts, and is there a way to verify the vote other than by hand counting?
Yes. I mean, you know, there are machine recounts. In Georgia in 2020, we did three hand recounts also of that year's election, which all showed, of course, that, you know, Donald Trump lost. And election deniers here, the election deniers who sit on our state election board, were pointing out that those three hand recounts, had three different margins of victory for Joe Biden back in 2020. And ironically, they used that as a way to question the results of the election. Well, how can we be sure that, you know, this election was up on the up and up if there were these three different margins of victory? Simultaneously, they are clamoring for hand counts of elections. They apparently do not have the self-awareness to realize that the reason that there's three margins of victories and three hand counts is because of the significant error rate that happens when we hand count paper ballots, when we have human beings going through stacks and stacks of, in Georgia, 7 million ballots and counting them by hand. Yeah, there's going to be different counts, right? Like, that's why the machines are used. That's why they were put in place, is because they are more reliable and less susceptible to errors like that.
Any predictions on what might happen in the November midterms in terms of election charges flying back and forth?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the good thing about the Trump administration is that they make everything pretty obvious of what they're going to do and what they're going to say. And we also have 2024 to look back on as well for evidence of what the game plan will be. But, you know, essentially, you know, what they're going to do is they are going to continue to sow distrust in elections in places like Georgia, which is why they raided the Fulton County Elections Warehouse, so that they can sift through those voluminous materials and sort of recirculate some of the claims that have been made about 2020 and fraud and ballots and all of that stuff to, you know, get everybody thinking about all of that again, you know. And so they're doing that to lay the groundwork for if Republicans lose, they can say, well, look at all these problems that we found. We had to raid Fulton County to get to the bottom of it. And then I think there's two other things, one nationally and one in Georgia, that are important to keep an eye on, which is that, you know, there is a very real possibility that Republicans in Congress don't actually want to pass the SAFE Act. What they want is they want to try to pass the SAFE Act and have it stopped by Democrats so that they can say, so that they can say, we tried to institute voter ID, which is, everybody supports voter ID, and they're right, right? I mean, that's not what the SAFE Act is, but let's put that aside for a moment. So they can say, we wanted to support voter ID, the Democrats stopped it because they're for fraud, and therefore, probably all these undocumented immigrants voted in this November election because we didn't have the SAFE Act in place, which it wouldn't be in place anyway, but it doesn't really matter, right? So they can say, we were for voter ID, a bunch of undocumented immigrants voted in November. And you're going to see a similar thing happen in Georgia with this deadline to create a new ballot system, which has to happen by July 1st. Republicans here are not going to simply create a law that narrowly focuses on that issue. Instead, they are going to try to institute hand-marked paper ballots. And then that's probably going to get vetoed by Governor Kemp. And then the Republicans in the state legislature can then say, we tried to do hand-marked paper ballots, but the rhinos, or, you know, the fake Republicans, they wouldn't let us do it. So all of this is just leading up.
Governor Kemp is a pretty conservative guy, right?
He is a pretty conservative guy. But what he's not is a dyed-in-the-wool election denier who's going to throw Georgia's election system into abject chaos by trying to institute a hand count of 7 million ballots in a midterm election 4 months ahead of time, right? He's not an insane person, right? So he's not going to do that.
And then, in addition to whatever the election deniers might say, there's the idea that Trump might just decide to cancel the elections.
Which I don't think that to me is not really a possibility.
If he provokes some incident, if he gets ICE, for example, to do something even more outrageous than they've done, and there's resistance, and he could say there's rioting, I have to declare martial law, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yes, that's entirely possible. I think it works better for him, though, and for Republicans, to simply call the results into question, or, you know, to do something like, you know, here's another possibility that people outside of Georgia may not really realize, to do something. You know, a lot of people have been talking about, oh, what if they send ICE to the polls, you know, and that's essentially voter suppression, right? Yes, I think that's entirely possible. You know, but in Georgia, this state election board, which is run by Trump acolytes, I mean, really hardcore election denier folks, they have the legal ability to take over election administration in every county in Georgia if they feel like they have a legal argument to do so. So, you know, they could potentially do that in Fulton County, which is, of course, the most important county in Georgia, which is going to be crucial to determining the makeup of the Senate, because John Ossoff is running against, you know, Buddy Carter and some other folks. And so, like, you know, they have other paths towards direct election interference than just canceling the election. And the biggest one is just the bully pulpit of saying this thing was rigged, this thing was fraudulent. And then we potentially get into Federal Contested Elections Act stuff, and Congress technically gets to choose its own members, and all sorts of fresh new constitutional legal ground stuff that is problematic for a lot of reasons.
That was independent journalist Justin Glaw speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the election deniers and how they might impact the midterm elections in November. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Artie Wall.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, the death toll and the dollar toll in the Iran war are very high. The human toll from the war is rapidly rising. By most accounts, about 3,000 people have been killed across the Middle East. Iran's representative to the UN has told the Security Council that more than 1,300 civilians had been killed. Dozens have also died in Iranian drone and missiles attacks on Gulf countries and Israel. In Lebanon, the Israeli bombardment, which has extended to downtown Beirut, has killed more than 700 people and displaced over 1 million, according to Lebanese officials. The U.S. death toll has reached 13. The Pentagon refuses to take responsibility for an airstrike at the start of the war that killed at least 175, including many children. The incident is still under official investigation, but unofficial investigations show U.S. responsibility and vitiate Trump's claim that an Iranian Tomahawk missile, which it doesn't possess, was responsible. The war wastes money as well as taking lives. As of a week ago, the U.S. military spent around $5.2 billion on munitions alone. That amount is greater than total U.S. humanitarian assistance in 2025. And munitions are only part of the cost. The Times reports, quote, Elaine McCusker, a top Pentagon official during the first Trump administration, estimates that by the end of its sixth day, the war's cost exceeded $11 billion, including more than $5 billion worth of interceptors. To replenish its arsenal, the Pentagon is expected to ask Congress for an additional $50 billion, unquote. Let's recall that the Pentagon's budget proposal for the next fiscal year is $1.5 trillion. In short, exceptional and unacceptable military spending is diverting the military from its true defense missions and from human and environmental needs at home. Peace is not at hand in this war. What will it take to end the war? On March 11, Iran outlined the conditions it said are needed to end the war. Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said ending the war would require three things. First, recognition of Iran's legitimate rights. Second, payment of reparations. And third, firm international guarantees against future aggression. He said that he conveyed this position during talks with the leaders of Russia and Pakistan, framing it as Tehran's proposed path to peace. As diplomats say, these conditions are a non-starter. No way in the world will the U.S. agree to any of the 3 points. Nor has Trump offered talks aimed at stopping the war. On March 15th, he said, quote, "Iran wants to make a deal, and I don't want to make it because the terms aren't good enough yet." What terms would be good enough for the United States remains unstated. Most likely is that only unconditional surrender, as Trump has mentioned, would suffice. It is up to NATO partners or the United Nations to come up with ways to stop the war, but one searches in vain for any effort to do so. One highly unlikely way the war will end is via a popular uprising in Iran. That one-time Trumpian fantasy has been dismissed by the Israelis, who believe protesters will, quote, "get slaughtered" in a revolt. That opinion is being reported in a cable circulated by the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem last Friday. The Israeli assessment is that Iran's regime is not cracking and is willing to, quote, "fight to the end." Yet various Israeli officials, including Benjamin Netanyahu, have urged the Iranian people to rise up, which would indeed be an invitation to the slaughterhouse. The fight for oil leaves Trump with few alternatives. Once again, a Middle East war has come down to oil. Iran has proven capable of choking off the Strait of Hormuz, disabling oil tankers with drones and mining in the narrow passage through which 20% of global oil shipments pass. Most oil companies and their insurers are unwilling to run the risk of shipping despite Trump's urging to show guts. He should know it's all about money, not guts. If guts are central, why hasn't the U.S. Navy escorted the tankers through the strait? Efforts to shore up the world's oil supply by releasing reserves and removing sanctions on Russian oil sales for 30 days are unlikely to work. Demand far exceeds what these measures can supply. That leaves more U.S. bombing, which Pete Hegseth assures everyone will be successful. The bombing now extends to Karg Island in the Persian Gulf, home to Iran's main oil exporting facilities. Trump is again using the word obliteration to characterize the bombing's results, but he applied that only to military targets. The U.S. Central Command says the strikes, quote, "preserved the oil infrastructure." As CNN reports, moreover, Iran is continuing to export oil through the strait. Quote, "Iran itself is shipping oil through the strait in almost the same volume as before the war, earning the much-needed cash to sustain its economy and war effort. In addition, there were already millions of barrels of Iranian crude oil at sea looking for buyers before the conflict began." Unquote. The price of oil, and therefore gasoline at the pump, continues to rise, causing Trump further political headaches. The Wall Street Journal reported that 3 CEOs from the major oil companies met with Trump's energy team and warned that the energy crisis is only going to get worse. But the Wall Street Journal report did not say that the executives criticized Trump's war policy. After all, big oil is benefiting enormously from this war. Oil problems may lead to postponement of Trump's trip to China, which was scheduled for March 31st, but whose agenda was not announced. Trump is appealing to China to join other countries in reopening the Strait of Hormuz to U.S. shipping. But for one thing, China does not move significant amounts of oil through the strait, contrary to what Trump is saying. Quote, "Seaborne oil imports through the strait now account for less than half of China's total oil shipments, according to Rush Doshi, director of the China Strategy Initiative at the Council on Foreign Relations." Second, China has evidently prepared for another energy crisis. It has oil supply options beyond the Middle East. And third, and most important, China's likely unwillingness to help Trump is surely based on a simple logic. Why take a stand on the side of U.S. aggression against Iran, a strategic partner? Trump has asked NATO to help end Iran's blockage, but Germany, Australia, Luxembourg, and Japan said that they have no plans to send vessels to the region. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said Monday, quote, "This is not our war. We have not started it." Chancellor Friedrich Merz was emphatic, quote, "This Iranian regime must come to an end, but, based on all the experience we have gained in previous years and decades, bombing it into submission is, in all likelihood, not the right approach," unquote. Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer said the UK would not be drawn into the wider war, but was working on a viable plan. "Any action would have to be agreed upon by many partners as possible in NATO," he said. Trump said it would be very bad for NATO's future if it did not help. But Japan is also hesitating. Prime Minister Takaichi Sennai said providing warships would be legally difficult. Trump is increasingly isolated in this war, a potentially dangerous situation. The deployment of 2,500 Marines to the Gulf area is an ominous sign of deeper U.S. involvement, perhaps in preparation for seizing Karg Island, or sabotaging what remains of Iran's nuclear establishment, or invading Iran outright. In other news, Russia is on the verge of banning Telegram. Telegram, the app most widely used by Russians for communicating, seems about to be banned by the government for, quote, abetting terrorism. Pavel Durov, the founder of Telegram, who lives in Abu Dhabi, says that, quote, Russia is restricting access to Telegram in an attempt to force its citizens to switch to a state-controlled app built for surveillance and political censorship, unquote. That app, known as Max, seems to be an attempt to force all Russians who use the internet onto it. The Kremlin charges that Telegram has been used by Ukraine and the West to undermine Russian authority. Durov, however, is no innocent. He has been charged with a range of crimes in France in connection with illicit activity on the app, including the distribution of child sexual abuse material, drug trafficking, and fraud. He faces a potential sentence of up to 10 years in prison. For Russia, the flip side of banning Telegram is hacking other social media. Russian hackers have focused on Signal and WhatsApp, according to Dutch intelligence, seeking the personal data of users in government and industry. But that's not abetting terrorism, evidently. The Pentagon is in a dispute with a major AI tech firm. Pete Hegseth is very angry with the AI tech firm Anthropic, which has a technology called Claude that the Pentagon wants to use for purposes Anthropic opposes. According to the Washington Post, the dispute is, quote, over whether the U.S. government should have the freedom to spy on or kill humans using Anthropic's technology. Anthropic has protested that the Pentagon wants to use Claude for surveillance of U.S. citizens and in autonomous weapons on the battlefield. Hegseth has denied such intentions and is threatening to use the technology regardless of Anthropic's complaint. Trump followed up by ordering the government to stop using Anthropic. But its CEO will not give in, saying that, quote, in a narrow set of cases, we believe AI can undermine rather than defend democratic values. In short, Anthropic does not seem aligned with the MAGA agenda. And according to a New York Times report, Silicon Valley is largely behind Anthropic. The latest word is that Anthropic is suing the Pentagon over the claim that Anthropic is a national security risk. Cuba is talking with the United States, but that may be a charade. In response to Trump's predictions that the Cuban government's downfall is imminent, Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, has acknowledged reports that it is in talks with the United States. By threatening high tariffs on any country that supplies Cuba with oil, and by cutting off Venezuelan oil shipments to Cuba, the U.S. has left the Cuban economy without imported oil for 3 months. It relies on those shipments for around 60% of its energy. Cuba thus is largely at the mercy of Trump. In the talks, Cuba's president has revealed his insistence that they must take place with mutual respect for each other's political systems, which is diametrically opposed to Trump's demand that the communist system be dismantled. Cuba seems willing to make economic changes, such as allowing exiles to invest in the island. It has also released some political prisoners, but that may not be enough to prevent what Trump and Rubio aim at. Cuba and the U.S. seem to be at roughly the same place Venezuela and the U.S. and Iran and the U.S. were at before the U.S. decision to attack. In other words, talking as though negotiating while the U.S. was actually planning regime change. As in the Venezuela case, Trump is demanding the resignation of President Díaz-Canel. Bloomberg reports that, quote, people familiar with the matter say Trump wants to use American economic pressure to make the island nation financially dependent on Washington. The U.S. would essentially take the place of its one-time rival, the Soviet Union, unquote. China seeks a growth rate somewhere between 4.5 and 5%. As the Chinese economy tries to shift from excess reliance on exports to more attention to consumption at home, the leadership is pushing for emphasis on high-quality development, which essentially means greater reliance on advanced technologies, AI, robotics, and semiconductors. The official explanation for seeking a growth rate of over 4% is that, quote, Economic growth must support goals such as stabilizing employment, stabilizing the market, and improving people's livelihoods. From the long-term perspective, it must be aligned with medium and long-term goals and long-term vision. This year is the first year of the 15th five-year plan. Based on the goal of achieving per capita GDP, reaching the level of moderately developed countries by 2035, the average annual growth rate for the next 10 years needs to reach 4.17%. This year's target, the official report concludes, is above this, reflecting a proactive and positive attitude of pushing ahead, unquote. New accusations of Israeli violations of international law. Israel is being accused of illegal chemical spraying of Syrian agricultural land by a French team that has provided video evidence. The use of herbicides in late January and early February seems to be connected with Israeli military operations in the buffer zone that separates Syria from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. That zone is supposed to be demilitarized. The herbicides presumably keep vegetation down, but they are causing significant crop losses to Syrian farmers. Chemical spraying by Israeli forces has also been reported in the West Bank and Lebanon. Finally, I want to call attention to the resignation on March 17 of Joe Kent, director of the National Counterterrorism Centers. His letter to President Trump said that, quote, Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. Early in this administration, the letter says, high-ranking Israeli officials and influential members of the American media employed a misinformation campaign that wholly undermined your America First platform and sowed pro-war sentiments to encourage a war with Iran. This echo chamber was used to deceive you into believing that Iran posed an imminent threat to the United States. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Tune up.